Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Tim McKenna.
Hello, Diane.
Hello, Tim. How are you?
Much warmer than last week.
And it still isn't warm.
No, but it's warmer, and I'll take that.
Okay, and now we have rain.
That's okay.
That is okay. Yes, I like rain. I actually saw my first green shoots coming up through the snow this week.
Let's hope that they can stay up and not get frozen when they're down.
And get smooshed back in. Well, you know the saying that so many whatever and so little time?
Yes.
Well, this time of year, that's what it's like to be the voice of cycling on the radio. There are so many good stories and people and projects, I can hardly catch my breath.
That's a good thing. And lots of neat projects.
There really are. This week, we're going to speak with three very interesting people with three very diverse cycling stories. For those of us, and I will include all of us, who are about to embark on the 2014 season with a few extra pounds from the long winter.
Just a couple.
Just a couple. Our first guest might be just the person to offer some direction and inspiration. Georgie Fear is a registered dietitian and a professional nutrition coach. She's worked with everyone from NCAA standouts to Olympians, and her new book, Racing Weight Cookbook, which was written along with Matt Fitzgerald, who came up with the whole racing weight program. The subtitle of the book, Lean Light Recipes for Athletes, was just published by Velo Press. It's got a very clever layout, which will encourage anyone and everyone to get involved in a healthier nutritional lifestyle. From the rider who would rather order takeout to the 8-course gourmet cook. We'll ask Georgie about her thoughts on diet, nutrition, and recipes. We'll then speak with Coach Dean Peterson. He coaches the Marion University cycling team, one of the most successful collegiate teams in the country. Coach Peterson is a Cat 1 cyclist himself, and from BMX to cyclocross and track, Marion University's Knights, K-N-I-G-H-T-S, are eagerly sought after by top teams worldwide. The MU collegiate program was recently detailed in a lengthy article in Velo News and included this short piece. Peterson has assembled a group of young riders that would make many a sport director drool. Marion cyclists, including as Caitlin Antoneau, Cannondale Cyclocross Worlds.com, David Williams, 5-Hour Energy Kenda, and Adam Leibovitz, Champion Systems Stands No Tubes, are finding success in the pro peloton during and after their time at the school. Two young riders, incoming freshman Logan Owen and Felicia Stansel, have already won multiple national or world championships. It's a great school offering a great education and a great cycling team, Owen said. It's cool to see a college invest the money and effort into cycling that Marion has. You see colleges do it for football or basketball, but never for cycling. And that's what impressed me, and that's why I wanted to speak with Dean Peterson today. We'll find out more about why MU does invest in the cycling program and how it became so popular and successful. Speaking of success, our final guest this evening is Lee Donovan, multi-time champion in mountain bike racing nationally and internationally. Lee recently launched her new program, iChooseBikes.com, to offer women a mountain biking as well as life experience that leads to confidence and success. We'll try to squeeze in a bit of news, but let's head on out to Vancouver, BC, and talk first with Georgie Fear about food and nutrition. Georgie, thank you for joining me on the show this evening.
Thanks for having me here.
We are finally seeing spring, sort of. I thought it'd be a good time to talk about nutrition for athletes, including those out there riding, running, swimming, and otherwise exercising this season. So tell us a little bit about who Georgie Fear is and what you do.
Sure. I'm a registered dietitian. I live in Canada now, but I actually grew up in the States, and I went to school at Rutgers University and Cornell University, so I'm from the New York, New Jersey area. And then I worked as Rutgers University sports nutritionist for a while and really got to love working with athletes. And then in some of my later opportunities, worked with athletes in Colorado and Wyoming, as well as clinical practice as well. And now I do my own thing for my own company up here in Vancouver, Canada.
Before you actually, or probably during the time you were either in school or working at Rutgers or at Cornell, what kinds of sports did you engage in? And as I remember, some of them were ultra-distance sports.
Yeah, I do. I definitely have a penchant for the slower, longer distances. When I was growing up, I was not very good at the ball sports, and so I think I just naturally gravitated towards things that involved straight lines. So, yeah, just, you know, put me on a road and tell me to go to the end of it, and I'm good. So I did marathoning starting in college. I think I ran my first marathon when I was 18 and had a blast and just loved it. I had a short stint of rowing crew, but then I just decided that, you know, distance running was my thing, and then gradually got onto doing the triathlon as well. Ran 50K at one point. That was kind of a fun box to check. And I think I just kind of enjoyed the marathons. I did get into biking centuries for a while, so those were kind of my favorites.
What are you doing now?
Well, right now I am, well, at this moment I'm rehabbing a back injury, but when I have my preference, I kind of still like walking, jogging, hiking, and I've really quite like weightlifting as well. So.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Yeah. As a professional nutritionist, what does that mean? Define that for me.
Sure. Well, basically all I do is work with people on their nutrition. I don't sell any supplements. I don't sell pills, and there's no meal plans or really any shtick to what I do. All I do is I work one-on-one with people, figuring out what is keeping them from their goals in terms of their nutrition, and then we work on changing those things one at a time. So I work with some of Canada's Olympic athletes who are training 6 hours a day, and I work with some absolutely regular people that just want to start exercising and get healthy. So I don't by any means work exclusively with athletes.
I think that when people, just ordinary people who are either riding or walking or running or maybe not even doing anything, the first thing they think about is, I want to lose weight. Is that what you hear a lot of?
A lot of, yeah. People depend. Sometimes they want weight loss as their primary goal. Sometimes performance is their primary goal. And sometimes they just want both and they want to know how much they can have both.
So I guess what I'm sort of aiming towards is when you change your nutritional habits, won't weight loss or weight, say, you know, it'll settle in where it needs to be if you are following a nutritional program?
Ideally, yes. A lot of times we don't have to worry too much about, you know, controlling amounts. One thing I absolutely hate is to have anybody have to count calories. So I don't count calories. I don't encourage people to count calories. And often if they come to me counting calories, I try and get them to stop in favor of good habits, such as, you know, eating more high-quality foods, paring back on some of the lower-quality foods, not skipping them entirely. You know, I love to have a square of chocolate every now and then. But shifting your diet so you're favoring more of the high-quality foods does often tend to produce a healthier body in people that are active, just kind of naturally.
I also want to talk about fads. So there are fads, sort of like don't eat fats. They're really bad for you. But the truth is, if you cut out all fats, that's really bad for you.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's always fads that come and go. I find them quite entertaining, personally.
I bet you do. That never occurred to me. That's great.
It's fabulous. You know, sometimes I think they do them all just for my entertainment. So fads, for example, I definitely supported the Snack Oils company when I was in high school. I had, like, the shelf of green boxes of fat-free cookies and, you know, fat-free graham crackers, and I was just munching my way through them after track practice. But a lot of people have found that when they start to slash the fat grams in their diet, that certain things happen. Mainly, you don't feel 100% satisfied after a meal. You start to get hungry even 60 minutes after you just ate. Did you ever feel that?
That's interesting. Well, I don't know, because I've never believed in taking fats out of my diet, so I've never experienced that.
Oh, you're just too level-headed.
I'm too level-headed. Yeah, well, in some ways I am, but I've never been one to just pull fat out of my diet just because, oh, that's the latest thing to do. It seems to me that's your body needs fat.
Absolutely. You know, fat helps us absorb vitamins and minerals. It helps us stay full because it triggers, you know, the release of certain hormones from the digestive tract that go to our brain and say, thumbs up, we got some good quality food here. We're going to be satisfied for a while. And it's critical to things like immune health and cardiovascular function. So, yeah, if you never cut out fat, you didn't miss too much of a fun thing.
That's a good thing. Let's talk a little bit about timing. Are there correct and incorrect times to eat certain foods? I know there is such a thing as food combining, and there are things like eat this before you exercise, this after you exercise. How important is the timing of your food intake?
I'm really glad you asked it that way and how important it is, because a lot of times people want to dichotomize it into, you know, I either obsess over it or I dismiss it. And really, it does matter, but it doesn't matter as much as the total intake. For example, if we want to make sure somebody has enough energy to train and to ride long on the weekends, we want to make sure they have enough overall carbohydrates to recover and to keep their glycogen stores topped up. But whether you get those at, you know, the bulk of them at 8 in the morning or the bulk of them at 8 p.m. doesn't make a huge difference. So timing is less important than your overall intake. Similarly, if you just eat too much overall, it doesn't matter how you time it, you're going to gain weight.
Eating so much.
Right. So reducing the overall, you know, getting the overall quantity right is by far more important than setting your stopwatch to, you know, time your specific nutrients. Likewise, food combining, same thing. It doesn't make too much of a difference when you eat what with what. It's the overall content works well. That said, there is some benefit to paying attention to when you consume certain things. For example, right after a strenuous workout or a really long ride, it's beneficial to preferentially make that meal higher in carbohydrates, because naturally you've just emptied your glycogen stores to a significant amount. It helps you recover. You want to consume more fluid at that time to help replenish your hydration stores. And then that naturally means that you may eat less at the times that you're inactive, such as when I'm hanging out on my couch watching TV at 8 p.m. I probably don't need to be too worried. If I've met my nutrient and carbohydrate needs earlier in the day, I can just kick back and, you know, just watch TV.
Right, exactly. Very, very interesting. I'm speaking with Georgie Fierce. She is the author of Racing Weight Cookbook, Lean Light Recipes for Athletes, along with Matt Fitzgerald. And we spoke with Matt Fitzgerald last year about his book, Racing Weight. So they sort of go hand in hand. I love the way your book is laid out. That is the coolest thing ever. So if you don't like to cook, there are recipes for people who either don't like or don't know how to cook, for those who cook a little, and for those who love to cook. And explain how you came up with the idea of those three sections and how you've sort of laid them out.
Well, we have to give a hat tip to Matt Fitzgerald for not only creating the racing weight system, which is a really just level-headed, scientifically backed approach to controlling weight. And he came up with the idea to have the cookbook and lay it out in that fashion. And what we laughed about was that level one was kind of like Matt-level recipes, because he is just not a fan of cooking whatsoever. So Matt was in charge of approving everything that was going to go in the first section. And then the way I cook, I typically stay in level two and level three. So for me to even create recipes that were going to go in level one, I found myself in aisles of the grocery store I have never been in before. So it was a really nice partnership to have, because he is absolutely eating for a function and a purpose, whereas I'm definitely scratching a creative itch in the kitchen. So we were able to meet both of our needs doing that.
I'm sorry, I'm on Matt's page.
Yeah.
Matt and I go hand in hand on that one. What happens when one of your clients comes to you and has real specific issues like celiac or diabetes or allergies? How do you tailor a program of nutrition for people like that?
Well, it's a benefit to me that I did my education the way I did, because doing a registered dietitian program and an internship and working in clinical medicine, I'm able to handle those kind of medical specialties. They really don't pose too much of a different approach, or they don't require too much of a different approach from a regular person who doesn't have a medical issue. You simply have to personalize things. So for somebody who is, let's say, has celiac disease or is gluten intolerant, obviously, we want to make sure that we're getting carbohydrates without using gluten-containing foods. But once you get over the initial shock of, oh my goodness, I need to buy gluten-free pasta, and over the sticker shock that gluten-free products can be a bit more pricey, it's really not too much of an adjustment. People readily adjust to, oh, okay, so I can try gluten-free pasta, or I can just have rice instead of orzo, and just make some swaps there, and there's plenty of gluten-free products available that there's really nothing that you have to be too deprived of. So I will admit that gluten-free pizza crust tends to leave something to be desired.
I actually eat gluten-free, and I stay away from pizza because of that.
Yeah, it's. I don't really view dietary restriction as so much deprivation as much as it's just the choice that you make, because if you are gluten-free for a medical reason, you have some pretty awful symptoms if you decide to go for it, ones that I don't think are necessarily worse, like as worth a perfectly chewy pizza crust. So
that's exactly right.
I'm
and
with
I
you.
I totally agree with that. The last thing I want to talk about is for somebody at this time of year, especially just beginning to get back out on the road, back into a training program, or somebody who might have been away from serious exercise for a while, what are the top maybe two or three things he or she should do nutritionally to start off?
For people that are coming back to just kind of warming up that early spring season, as you do with your training, you want to increase it gradually so you don't, you know, shock your system too much and end up really sore or worse off injured before you even get going. And similarly with nutrition, starting with moderate steps tends to be much more productive in the whole season sense, as opposed to trying to boot camp yourself and cutting out all of the sweets and overhauling everything that you eat. So I think my first tip would be start gradually, pick one thing and change that, and then try and change another thing. The racing weight system is based on 6 points, such, and I'm not going to be able to pull all six out of memory, but such as eating higher quality foods, monitoring your performance. So, you know, I think picking one of those is a great place to start, and then moving to another one as you kind of get into it. Don't feel like you have to change everything by Friday.
Oh, and then, why not?
Well, if you try and change everything, we tend to get overwhelmed, and then there's this, like, homesick kind of feeling, and we just go back to what's familiar.
It's an interesting point, and I think that's what happens with a lot of dieting.
Yeah, and then I think the second tip that I would give would be to think about bringing in more healthy food instead of just cutting things out. A lot of times when people decide that they want to get into shape or lose some extra weight, they think that it's all about giving up and taking away and less, when actually I prefer to view it as adding in more of the filling fruits and vegetables, more of the whole grains, and that it displaces some of the less beneficial things on your plate.
Well, those are really interesting and helpful tips. The name of the book, again, is Racing Weight Cookbook, Lean Light Recipes for Athletes. It is a product of Velo Press, and you can probably get it at Amazon, I take it, and at the Velo Press website.
Absolutely, and at a lot of regional bookstores, local bookstores, and the major chains as well.
It's Georgie Fear. She is a professional nutritionist, and she wrote the book along with Matt Fitzgerald, who wrote the Racing Weight series. Well, Georgie, thanks so much for talking to us. This is a good time of year to start looking at nutrition and figuring out what the right thing is for you when it comes to food. Have a great evening.
You too, Diane. Thank
All right.
you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Georgie Fear, professional nutritionist, and what a nice lady. I really enjoyed her Racing Weight Cookbook. It's a nice book. You want to borrow it?
Yes, I do. Well, just one third of it. Certainly not the others, but I do. I think that's a great idea, breaking it down how you cook. And so many times that we seem to have issues with trying to pick through a big book that cooks for everyone and not just what we're looking for. So great idea. And I know if you go to her website, AskGeorgie.com, there's a link for her book also.
Okie doke. Oh, AskGeorgie.com. There we go. Well, we are going to head on out to a bus, it turns out, on its way to Dayton, between Indianapolis and Dayton. We're going to speak with Coach Dean Peterson. He is the cycling coach for the Marion University cycling team. Dean Peterson, thanks so much for joining me on The Outspoken Cyclist this evening.
Thanks for having me. We're excited to be on.
Well, it's pretty exciting to know about your fabulous cycling team. It's a collegiate cycling program. We don't get to talk to many coaches at that level. Marion University seems to be way ahead of the curve in college cycling. Tell us a little bit about the school and its commitment to cycling, because it seems to be pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is. It actually began in 1992 when we first started offering scholarships to cyclists from around the country, actually from around the world, very early on. as a result, really, of having the velodrome right next to our campus. And that was the impetus, really, the track and the president at the time seeing that it was an active track and it was a great way to potentially bring in new students. And a lot of our students were either involved over there and participating as part of the spectatorship of the track, or were actually riding over there already. So that's how we got going, starting in 1992, and kind of fast forward to 2014, from maybe six or seven riders in the beginning in 1992, we're at 52 now in five different disciplines.
Wow. How big is Marion University? What is the actual student population?
We're just under 3,000 students, mostly undergraduate, with some graduate programs that have been developing in the last few years, and the addition of our first class of med school students on campus now.
Wow.
So this is our first year with med students on campus, and it's a great thing.
When I first learned about you and the cycling team, the article that I read was about really the women's team, but you don't just have a women's team.
No, we do not. It's a co-ed team, and the fact is, to be good in collegiate cycling at a national level, at any level, you have to have a balanced team because the scoring is combined. Men and women have an equal spot at the table in terms of points that they bring to the full team scoring. So to win, you know, a weekend of road racing, or a weekend at BMX Nationals, or a weekend in cyclocross, whatever it may be, it typically takes strength on both sides. So you know, your focus is to build both sides, and the recruiting and the development is quite balanced.
That's interesting. So unlike out in the real world of pro cycling, where the women are sort of, you know, off the back, so to speak, women count a lot in collegiate cycling.
Absolutely. And that's one of the greatest things built into the scoring system and the overall, the overall build of collegiate cycling since it started. So, you know, there are points, and it's also leveled. So riders of all levels, for example, for the road season, which is the most robust season we have, there's 10 weekends of racing. We race with category 5, 4, 3s, 2s, and 1s, and there's races all day, and all of their points from the various races, men and women, collectively go to the team score.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty neat.
It is neat. It's very neat. I really like that. I like that a lot. So you have a lot of disciplines. Let me ask you about the equipment, because cycling is not a cheap sport. So how is this program funded? And you're still recruiting, and you've got scholarships. How is all that happening?
Well, that's the commitment from the school is, you know, I don't think that no school takes it on without really taking a close look at the financial aspect of something like this. But, you know, first and foremost, it's Marion that sees this as a model that works financially. But it works really because you know, there is, beyond the success of the team, the team with the numbers we now have in terms of actual students going to school, and they are paying, you know, some amount to be here, of course. So that helps the model work in terms of, them being paying clientele of the school, so to speak, even though they are subsidized and help to come along and be part of a student athlete program, and we look at that in the cleanest sense. They are students first, and they are athletes that actually enjoy and have fun racing their bikes and doing something as part of a team and representing the school. That's where the school sees, you know, the value beyond the actual financial side. The value in it for the school is that we have a lot of kids on campus that are committed student athletes and we've been very fortunate to be very successful as well. And that gives us good exposure, a small school like ours, where small schools are competing very aggressively for, you know, to bring students to their schools. This has been a great way for us and a great avenue for us to get our name out there in front of people.
I'm speaking with Dean Peterson. He is the coach of the Marion University cycling team, probably one of, if not the most successful cycling teams on the collegiate level. So you actually have riders who either have been picked up or are being picked up for pro riding. In fact, I think you have an incoming freshman, last name Owen maybe, who's doing really, really well. Tell us how that is working when these kids have, you know, they're carrying, what, 13, 15 credit hours, too?
Mm-hmm. They have to carry. I mean, there are eligibility requirements that, you know, USA Cycling is the governing body. So this is not an NCAA or an NAIA sport. So, there are guidelines, however, that are somewhat designed after, you know, other governing bodies' guidelines. And so being a 12-credit-hour student, being in good social standing, financial standing, and all of the other things you have to do as being a good student-athlete on campus is the first thing. So they have busy days, 12-credit-hours in college, and many of them carry more than that to finish on time. They're busy doing that. So if you take Katie Antino, which is, she's a great story of Marion cycling. She definitely was doing 15 to 18 hours each semester so she could finish on time. And she's finishing this semester and at the same time race a professional career and race for the national team and race for Marion.
Wow.
She was very busy, and she gave up a lot of what I suppose people would call traditional kind of college time to basically be with her friends that were cyclists, travel with them, and study. That's what she did.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, and occasionally she slept in eight.
Luckily, she had fun.
Yeah, well, that's good. Riding your bike is fun. I do. So I want to ask a question that is an ugly question, and that is about doping. And obviously, you are the coach. You come from cycling. You're a Cat 1 racer. How are colleges dealing with the issue of doping as these youngsters become pros and then, you know, end up on a team and maybe are faced with that as a possibility?
That's a great question. I don't think it's ugly. I think it's an important thing to recognize that it's unfortunately a part of athletics. Cycling certainly has highlighted it more in recent years. But at the end of the day, what I hope colleges are doing and what we're doing is drug testing student athletes. And so we do have a drug testing program for our whole athletic department. And on top of that, our top athletes do get tested, and USA Cycling tests at national championships at collegiate national championships. So it's, there are three different systems kind of working together there, kind of on-site, and then for the higher-level riders, they get tested. USADA will show up on campus for some riders and test them along with USA Cycling, making sure that at national championships they're hitting it as well. So our school has taken it seriously, not just for cyclists, but for all student athletes, recognizing that it's there and that we really want for the athletes to make good decisions and compete clean.
That would be nice. So, we need a new generation of clean cyclists.
I really hope that it's happening. Okay, so the bus has awakened.
I can tell. It's okay. We don't mind a little ambient noise. Don't worry about it. Well, you know what? This has been a great conversation, and you are not far from us. Someday I'd like to really come out and take a look at your facilities. That would be kind of fun.
We'd love to have you.
That would be fun. Well, lots of luck with this year's crop of kids. And next year, I'm going to be watching collegiate cycling. We have talked to other people involved in it, but never a coach before. And I'm really, really happy to have been able to speak with you.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity, and I appreciate that you're not only taking a look at Marion University cycling, but highlighting collegiate cycling as one of the greatest areas of cycling, in my opinion, going on. And it's a tremendous thing to couple education and cycling, and where kids have opportunities like this.
Obviously, you're doing a good job as a coach. You got a lot of winners.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. You have a great weekend, and, you know, rubber side down.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Okay. Bye-bye, Dean.
Yeah.
Dean Peterson joined me from the bus on his way to a BMX race.
I noticed they had some of their athletes up here in Cleveland last week for the Case Criterium around Browns Stadium.
Obviously, I was asleep for that one.
No, it was cold and snowy, remember?
Yes, I do know. He seems like such a cool guy and so committed to his team. I love it.
Yeah, more of those motivated people that are interested in the sport itself and the kids, not the glory that he might get.
Exactly. So at this point in our show, I would like to take a moment to honor and acknowledge Joe Giampapa, a much-beloved rider from the Columbus, Ohio area who was hit and killed recently on a spring training ride. Steve Wartenberg, the cycling blogger for the Columbus Dispatch, had this to say this week in his blog. I never met Joe, but corresponded with him by email back in 2010 after we both accomplished one of the greatest cycling achievements, climbing the infamous Mont Ventoux in France 3 times in 1 day. This is a reminder that he and we aren't statistics. We're flesh and blood human beings with families and friends. We're productive members of society who love to ride and follow all the rules of the road. All we ask, and the law requires, is for drivers to pay attention, drive safely, and pass us properly. We want to enjoy the ride and get home safely. There was a ride for Joe in Columbus on Thursday that preceded a vigil. The purpose of the vigil was to honor the cyclist whose life was tragically cut short by a negligent motorist, to peacefully demonstrate the need for increased motorist awareness of cyclists, and to provide an open, casual forum for bicyclists to gather and discuss issues. I am going to take a short break at this point in our show to allow you to remember someone who you may have lost in this manner, and to remember Joe and his family. We'll be right back after a break. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
On Tuesday, April 22nd, engage Earth Day 2014 and join Cleveland Metro Parks in a special walk and environmental discussion along the banks of the Cuyahoga River in Metro Parks, Ohio and Erie Canal Reservation. Walkers will have a chance to reflect on the Cuyahoga's historic role as a rallying point for environmental change, along with its continuing recovery and challenges that remain. This event steps off at 3:30 p.m. from the Harvard Road Trailhead on Old Harvard Road between Jennings and Harvard Avenue. More information at clevelandmetroparks.com.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
Wanted to squeeze in a little news here before we head on out to California for our final interview of the evening?
Yes.
What do you got?
Quick update on our friend Rob Jones, who's traveling from Bar Harbor, Maine to... He's going all the way to California. Actually, Camp Pendleton is where he's going to end his ride. He's in San Francisco already.
Jeez. He was going like 30 miles a day. How did he get that far?
Remember, we had that really cold weather for so long down in, Georgia and all of that, where he really got delayed. But last week he was in Utah. This week he's made it to just into San Francisco. So making progress. It's good to hear.
It is good to hear. The best video of the week?
Yes.
It's a Vimeo. So it's Vimeo.com, and you need to write this down if you want to see it, because it's a long series of numbers. It's 7358-1450. And It's adorable. It's only 60 seconds. Somebody actually animated the evolution of the bicycle from this little wooden cart all the way through what we see today in 60 seconds. It's a very clean, crisp, and simple animation. It's adorable. So that's my vote for the video of the week.
We've reported in the past on the Boulder, Colorado man who got caught stealing 43 high-end bicycles.
To the tune of, like, what, $147,000 or something?
$169,000.
Oh, price went up.
So they got creative with the felonies and the way that everything was stacked up, and he now is facing 30 felony charges. That's
Yoo-hoo!
The update. So somebody did their math correctly, and when he got so many, they bumped him up into another category, so I think they got him on this one.
Did they ever find any bikes, though?
Not yet.
How sad, how sad. People might remember that last year there was sort of this uproar when Peter Sagan was up on the podium and grabbed one of the cute little girls who presents flowers and stuff's butt, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You're not too happy with him either, huh? Okay. Well, the headline underneath a photo reads, "Sexism, Apathy, Injury, Death. From city commuters to elite professionals, women in the saddle have had it too tough for too long. Finally, female cycling is about to step up a gear." This comes from The Independent in the UK, written by Simon Usborne. He said, "A year ago, Peter Sagan, a jockish Slovakian road racer, pinched the bottom of a young podium girl as she kissed the winner of the Tour of Flanders. As a scandal, it was minor by cycling standards, but it symbolized a major issue. The cyclist who had finished second in the Belgian Classic apologized, but his actions and their fallout had already said something more about a sport in which women have often been valued for their bearing in tight dresses. Because what few fans gleaned in the coverage of the pinch was that on the same day, the brilliant Dutch cyclist Marianne Vos won the women's version of the race. Typically, it had not been televised." Now, Marianne Vos is somebody I've been trying to reach to get on the show. She is just an amazing, amazing cyclist, world class. So the article goes on to say what's going to be happening in the upcoming season with women. And it includes how the race after on the last day of the Tour de France will come down the Champs-Élysées. They are starting to finally recognize that maybe women should not be treated as second-class citizens in cycling. But we'll see. There's even going to be money in this race in France.
Google Glass, one of the latest high-tech things. Google and Luxottica have announced a partnership to develop smart eyewear together in the immediate future. So that means for the folks of us that would be wearing Ray-Bans and Oakleys and things like that,
Luxottica owns
yes.
Oakley now. Hmm.
Yep.
Somehow I missed that. Okay.
So it's possible that you could have your Google Glass or Oakley Glass, if that's what they're going to call it, while you're riding your bicycle.
Wouldn't that be distracting?
Yes, I think so. I haven't had the opportunity to wear any Google Glass, but I certainly think that it would. If it's a heads-up display in a car, that may be a little bit different, but I just think there's too many things going on when you're on a bicycle that I don't know.
I don't know either, but are they giving any time frame as to when this might be available?
No, that's why they just said the immediate future. They're going to work at it as quickly as they can. But, the other thing is that then possibly bites into the whole category of cycling computers and the other technology. It could change all of that. It could make some of that obsolete. It could make things better, but I'm still not sure how that's going to work out on a bike. I don't know.
Okay. All right. Unfortunately, I don't think we have time for much more. We are going to head on out to Orange County. I think it's the city of Orange, California, and talk with Lee Donovan, a world-class mountain bike and BMXer. Lee, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Thank you, Diane.
Okay. Can I make you laugh?
Yeah, you can try and make me laugh.
Well, everybody says you have a killer laugh. That's what I read. I want to hear you laugh. Well, I'll make you laugh later, okay?
All right. Sounds good.
Okay. So seriously, tell us about yourself, what your background is, how you got into cycling, and what you're doing right now. And we're going to talk about a whole bunch of stuff. But just give us a little background about Lee Donovan.
I was born and raised in the same town I live in Orange, California. And my dad is what you would call a typical little league dad, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom, and she just she did whatever she could to support my dad's dreams, which was making my sister and I become athletes. And when I was about 5, I came across this bicycle at a garage sale. And I had ridden bikes, but this bike was specifically really cool and had a big banana seat. My dad bought it for me, and I started riding it on these little dirt jumps down the street from our house with all my neighbor friends.
So you got this cool little Schwinn. You started racing BMX, right?
Well, I started racing BMX when I was 11. So it took me quite a few years to come across the bike racing, the BMX bike racing. Like I said, we did a lot of sports. We did dance and gymnastics and played softball. And, you know, my dad played semi-pro baseball till he was 40. So he was on the AA baseball team that he ran every Sunday. So a lot of our life was spent every Sunday. I'd go out with my dad and I'd drag the field, line up the bases, chalk the field, the lines, be in the dugout, make sure everybody had their chew or their gum situated. I was kind of like the coach's assistant, so to speak, but I was, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old.
That's cool. Instead of being Bat Girl, you were the coach's
assistant. I was
definitely
not a Bat Girl. And I always remember thinking that I was going to be the first professional woman baseball player. I was pretty, pretty confident that was going to be me.
Well, what took you away from baseball then?
One day I drove over to this area by my grandparents' house. I saw these lights. And it was at night, it was like a Friday night, and went over, and I mean, immediately it was, you know how like they say, it's the
yes,
that moment where you just connect with something.
Yes,
that was it. I saw a BMX track, and my whole life changed from that moment forward when it came to sports.
You know what we call that, don't you?
No.
The bicycle gene. It kicks in.
Yes,
you know?
The bicycle gene.
There
yes.
are so many people who, once they touch that first bicycle or jump that first jump or go around that first crit, you know, 1 mile course, that's it. They're done. There is nothing else. And that changes the relationship with the bicycle. So you have so many championships. I couldn't even begin to list them. So let's just move forward in your career. So you fell in love with this whole thing with the lights and the event. And then what?
And then it took me about 9 months to convince my dad to let me race BMX. He thought it was very dangerous, and he wasn't comfortable with it. He didn't understand it. You know, he was a baseball player, and he understood team sports, and he understood the traditional sport world. So after about 9 months, my dad, I'd gotten all the kids in our neighborhood. I had five boys on my block. I got them all racing BMX. And so I was going out all the time watching them, and sometimes I would sneak out on the track and ride their bike or something. But eventually my dad came around and bought another bike at a garage sale. It was a Powerlite at the time. And I got a Simpson motocross helmet. And went out, and I think it was October 18th, 1982, and raced my first BMX race.
So tell me what it was like being a BMX racer and being a woman or a girl as opposed to being a boy. Because when we think of BMX, we think of boys. And today, you know, there are 30-something-year-olds still racing BMX, and they're still racing little tiny bikes for the most part. What did it feel like, and how many other girls were out there racing with you, if any?
You know, there was a lot of girls. I mean, if you're going to compare, the males to the females, there was definitely way more males than females. But, you know, that didn't stop a lot of females from being out there. I started racing at the Orange YMCA here. It's the number one track in the nation. I just never thought of myself as one sex or the other sex. I never like put myself in a box and said, oh, I'm female and I have to do this. I wasn't raised that way. I had tons of girlfriends. I had tons of boyfriends. And when I went out, it just seemed really natural for me. I will say that throughout the years, I started having stronger friendships with men than women because I would connect more with the men or the males. And then eventually what ended up happening was, you know, I grew up into a woman and realized that I still wanted those female relationships.
Right. Were you treated any differently as you began winning races and as you began moving up the ranks and becoming a champion? Or did the sport treat you differently, I guess, is the question I'm really looking for.
Well, I think that for girls in BMX, there really was there was no long-term goal at the time. This was in the 80s. There wasn't a pro class at the time. There wasn't the Olympics. So for a girl, I mean, it was a short-term goal, right? And I did it until I was almost 18. So I raced for, it was like 7 or 8 years I raced BMX. And I loved it. I really did it for, it was a great sport. I loved my friendships. I had so many opportunities to travel across the country. I gained a ton of independence. And you know, that the BMX racers became my family. And it was different than going to school and those types of friendships. These are people that I would spend, you know, days in and out with the same people. And I really never felt I was treated differently. My opportunities were just limited compared to the males.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I like that. So if that's the case, you actually won an award, the Richard Long Sportsmanship Award, and you're the only female to ever win that award. So what was that award? What is that award? And how did you become the winner of that award?
The award was, it was a sportsmanship award. And it was given through USA Cycling. And, you know, that was the year I retired from mountain biking. And I always felt like I had incredible sportsmanship. You know, I mean, when you're winning a lot of races, you definitely have a lot of people that are after you and, you know, aren't big fans. Your competitors aren't great big fans. But I just was always gracious to everyone, and I loved seeing people win, and I loved the opportunity to get to know the promoters and the organizers and the volunteers. That was just my style all the time. But I do think in 2001 specifically, I knew it was my last year, and I wanted to remember all these people that really made my career happen. And so, you know, I probably was put more energy into those relationships and that sportsmanship side than being a racer that year.
I'm speaking with Lee Donovan. She is just a champion. Mountain bike, BMX, just amazing. And we are going to talk a little bit about what Tangerine was, because I think it was a women's store.
Yeah, so in 2001, when I retired, I raced for Schwinn Bicycle.
Okay.
Bicycle company. And unfortunately, they went bankrupt. And so my salary stopped coming in September of 2001, which I was supposed to be paid through the end of the year. So I kind of started getting nervous, and I started looking for jobs within the bike industry. And I really just felt like I was coming up with a lot of roadblocks. And so I knew that I was going to have to figure something out on my own, that being a successful bike racer didn't equal an opportunity to work in the bike industry. And which I felt, you know, honestly, it was very depressing. It was, I felt like I'd given my whole life to bikes. And then when my racing career was over, it was like the door got shut on me.
So now do you understand why I asked you the question as to whether or not you were treated differently racing? So that was that side of it.
Right.
I'm seeing some changes now, but I would imagine in 2001, I think back, that's what, 13 years ago, you would run up against that roadblock. And I have to say, from the industry perspective, I apologize for the industry being that screwed up.
I know for me, it was actually, it was a gift. I needed to prove myself, and I needed to find out what I was capable of. I really, you know, I just was an athlete, and I didn't know what those skills actually equaled in the real world. And
that's a good point.
And you know what I came to find was when I decided that I really wanted to own a retail business, and I love clothes and fashion, and I always have. and I've never had the opportunity to really tap into that. The opportunity arose that I could open a business, and I could go buy clothes that I loved and sell them, and I could capitalize on all these skills that I didn't even know I had. I didn't know that I was great at customer service, or I didn't know I was great at balance sheets and profit and loss, and I didn't know any of these things. I had no idea that I knew so many things about life that I could be successful doing a number of jobs. I didn't know I was great at sales, or, you know, there was just so many experiences I had, and Tangerine helped all those things happen. Tangerine was a women's clothing boutique. It started out that way, and about 5 years after we opened, we had tons of men and tons of kids that also wanted us to sell that same level of clothes to the town we were in. And by the end of the 8 years, we carried about 20% men, about 70% women, and about 10% kids.
Nice. And obviously, that door closed, and open up iChooseBikes.com. So tell us what that is and where you're going with it.
Yeah, so when we closed the business, I hadn't been riding my bike much for about those 8 years. And I started, you know, I took a lot of time off. I took off about 6 months. And I just started riding my bike, enjoying my family. And the one thing I realized is how much I had missed my bike and what a different person I had become without my bike. And so being back on the bike was wonderful. And while I was riding one of the local trails, I ran into some girlfriends that I hadn't seen in about 10 years. And they had asked, oh, would you be interested in doing a clinic with our club? And I said, absolutely. So, you know, that experience kind of opened the idea of starting I Choose Bikes. I do choose bikes. It's something that really has always made me happy, I guess, because I was born with a bicycle gene.
That's correct.
But
we've established that.
and I think that I just started thinking more and more about it. I did go work for Interbike for a year and a half. And while I was at Interbike, regaining a lot of those relationships and having the opportunity to be back in the bike industry just solidified that I need to be here. I need to be on the education side of teaching people how to ride bikes, and especially women. I know that's something I'm great at. And I know there's a lot of women out there that are doing that currently. And I thought, you know, I'm well respected in the industry. Why not have another strong voice pushing this message?
And so you do.
And so I do.
And so you do. So run us through what happens with one of your clinics, and who's signing up for these clinics, and where are they?
For the last 5 years, I've been doing clinics with Ray's Indoor Mountain Bike Parks, the one in Cleveland and the one in Milwaukee.
Yay!
And typically we get about 200 women at each one of those events.
It's unbelievable.
So, yeah, it's phenomenal. I mean, and you know, everyone always has something really positive to say, and I have to say, from the first year that I started attending to this year, I still see this a lot of the same faces, and many of these women have become my friends, so that's been really neat. But when people sign up for the events, it's really, I work with the locations themselves. So Ray's hires me to put on an event.
Got it.
I'll reach out to people that, like, we do a series here in Southern California called Over the Hump, and I really noticed how few women were out there racing. So this year I offered three free women's clinics before a race, so a two-hour clinic before the race starts, so I could go over the course with women and get them, you know, knowledgeable. A lot of the work I try to do is I try and do as many free clinics as I can. And thank goodness for, you know, my sponsors like Live Giant, SRAM, Troily Designs, RockShox. Those people, they allow me to be able to offer free clinics.
What's your typical, or who is your typical client?
Oh, gosh. I mean, it's from the first-time beginner rider to a pro downhiller.
Wow.
you know, I do have a lot of credibility in the downhill world, so I do get a lot of downhillers that are interested, but the main focus of all my clinics is skills, like fundamental skills work, and so I will get a lot of downhillers that will come, and they'll start going, oh my God, this is like so lame, and then I say, you know what, just give me an hour, and I will change your mind. And by the end of the hour, they're blown away at just the skills that they've gotten in 1 hour. And just last summer, I did an event at Mammoth, and I had one of the girls kind of say something to me, oh, you know, I don't know if I need this. And I go, you know what, give me an hour, and I'm going to work with you, and then you tell me what you think. And she had this jump that she'd always wanted to clear in Mammoth, and she had never cleared it. And all they did was work on these tiny little techniques with her. And then that afternoon, she jumped this huge jump that she had never jumped before. And she came back and she said, you were right. That's all I needed.
I wish we had all day to talk. This is so fascinating. And you are fun. And I love what you're doing. Tell people how they can find out about I Choose Bikes.
You can visit the website, ichoosebikes.com. And I have the events on there. I have local coaches. So if you live in Wyoming, I have a coach that you can find in Wyoming. And if you live in Florida, there's a coach on there that you can find in your area.
I see. That's very good idea. Great idea.
You know, I Choose Bikes is about promoting and helping people get on the bike. And it's not about Lee Donovan. Your Lee Donovan's just helping get it out there. But I want to promote all those local coaches. And if any of local coaches out there around the country that specialize in coaching women are listening, please send me an email at ichoosebikes@gmail.com, and I will get you added to my website.
Well, that is awesome. Lee, thank you so much for talking with me on the show. Next time you come to Cleveland, you have to promise to let me know.
I will see you next February.
Oh,
so I
alrighty
really
then.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
All right. You have a great night.
You too, Diane.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Lee Donovan joined me from her home in Orange, California. She was fun.
Lots of fun.
Well, I hope when she comes back next year, I get a chance to actually meet her in person. It was fun talking with her. She obviously has a lot on the ball. So that's our show for this week. I'd like to thank our guests, Georgie Fear, Dean Peterson, and Lee Donovan, for 3 great conversations. The Outspoken Cyclist will be airing an encore presentation next Saturday, April 5th. But we will be back with a brand new show on April 12th. Our guests will include Congressman Earl Blumenauer from Oregon, a New York Times reporter and author of the bestseller Cycle of Lies, Juliet Maker, and explorer and first person ever to reach the South Pole by bicycle, Marie Leijerstam. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a great week. If you can, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at wjcu.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at wjcu.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.